This is Running 1,000 Miles for Freedom by William and Ellen Craft, read by Tom White. Preface. Having heard while in slavery that God made of one blood all nations of men, and also that the American Declaration of Independence says that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, we could not understand by what right we were held as chattels. Therefore, we felt perfectly justified in undertaking the dangerous and exciting task of running 1,000 miles in order to obtain those rights which are so vividly set forth in the Declaration. I begged those who would know the particulars of our journey to peruse these pages. This book is not intended as a full history of the life of my wife, nor of myself, but merely as an account of our escape, together with other matter which I hope may be the means of creating in some minds a deeper abhorrence of the sinful and abominable practice of enslaving, brutifying our fellow creatures. Without stopping to write a long apology for offering this little volume to the public, I shall commence at once to pursue my simple story. W. Craft. Part 1. God gave us only over beast, fish, fowl, dominion, absolute, that right we hold by his donation. But man over man he made not lord, such title to himself reserving, human left from human free. Milton. My wife and myself were born in different towns in the state of Georgia, which is one of the principal slave states. It is true our condition as slaves was not by any means the worst, but the mere idea that we were held as chattels and deprived of all legal rights, the thought that we had to give up our hard earnings to a tyrant to enable him to live in idleness and luxury, the thought that we could not call the bones and sinews that God gave us our own, but above all the fact that another man had the power to tear from our cradle the newborn babe and sell it into shambles like a brute, and then scourge us if we dared to lift a finger to save it from such a fate, haunted us for years. But in December 1848, a plan suggested itself that proved quite successful. And in 8 days after it was first thought of, we were free from the horrible trammels of slavery, rejoicing and praising God in the glorious sunshine of liberty. My wife's first master was her father, and her mother his slave, and the latter is still the slave of his widow. Notwithstanding my wife being of African extraction on her mother's side, she is almost white. In fact, she is so nearly so that the tyrannical old lady to whom she first belonged became so annoyed at finding her frequently mistaken for a child of the family that she gave her, when 11 years of age, to a daughter as a wedding present. This separated my wife from her mother and also from several other dear friends. But the incessant cruelty of her old mistress made the change of owners or treatment so desirable that she did not grumble much at this cruel separation. It may be remembered that slavery in America is not at all confined to persons of any particular complexion. There are a very large number of slaves as white as anyone. But as the evidence of a slave is not admitted in court against a free white person, it is almost impossible for a white child, after having been kidnapped and sold into or reduced to slavery, in a part of the country where it is not known as often as the case, ever to recover its freedom. I have myself conversed with several slaves who told me that their parents were white and free, but that they were stolen away from them and sold when quite young. As they could not tell their address, and also as the parents did not know what had become of their lost and dear little ones, of course, all traces of each other were gone. The following facts are sufficient to prove that he who has the power and is inhuman enough to trample upon the sacred rights of the weak cares nothing for race or color. In March 1818, three ships arrived at New Orleans bringing several hundred German immigrants from the province of Alsace on the Lower Rhine. Among them were Daniel Mueller and his two daughters, Dorothea and Salome, whose mother died on the passage. Soon after his arrival, Mueller, taking with him his two daughters, both young children, went up the river to Attakapas Parish to work on the plantation of John F. Miller. A few weeks later, his relatives, who had remained at New Orleans, learned that he had died of the fever of the country. They immediately sent for the two girls, but they had disappeared. And the relatives, notwithstanding repeated and persevering inquiries and researches, could find no traces of them. They were at length given up for dead. Dorothea was never again heard of, nor was anything known of Salome from 1818 till 1843. In the summer of that year, Madame Carl, a German woman who had come over in the same ship with the Muellers, was passing through a street in New Orleans and accidentally saw Salome in a wine shop belonging to Louis de Belmonte, by whom she was held as a slave. Madame Carl recognized her at once and carried her to the house of another German woman, Mrs. Schubert, who was Salome's cousin and godmother, and who no sooner set eyes on her than, without having any intimation that the discovery had been previously made, she unhesitatingly exclaimed, "Oh my God, here is the long-lost Salome Mueller." The Law Reporter, in its account of this case, says, "As many of the German immigrants of 1818 as could be gathered together were brought to the house of Mrs. Schubert, and every one of the number who had any recollection of the little girl upon the passage, or any acquaintance with her father and mother, immediately identified the woman before them as the long-lost Salome Mueller. By all these witnesses who appeared at the trial, the identity was fully established. The family resemblance in every feature was declared to be so remarkable that some of the witnesses did not hesitate to say that they should know her among 10,000, that they were certain the plaintiff was Salome Mueller, the daughter of Daniel and Dorothea Mueller, as of their own existence. Among the witnesses who appeared in court was the midwife who had assisted at the birth of Salome. She testified to the existence of certain peculiar marks upon the body of the child, which were found exactly as described by the surgeons who were appointed by the court to make an examination for the purpose. There was no trace of African descent in any feature of Salome Mueller. She had long, straight black hair, hazel eyes, thin lips, and a Roman nose. The complexion of her face and neck was as dark as that of the darkest brunette. It appears, however, that during the 25 years of her servitude, she had been exposed to the sun's rays in the hot climate of Louisiana with head and neck unsheltered, as is customary with the female slaves while laboring in the cotton or the sugar field. Those parts of her person which had been shielded from the sun were comparatively white. Belmonte, the pretended owner of the girl, had obtained possession of her by an act of sale from John F. Miller, the planter in whose service Salome's father died. This Miller was a man of consideration and substance, owning large sugar estates, and bearing a high reputation for honor and honesty, and for indulgent treatment of his slaves. It was testified on the trial that he had said to Belmonte a few weeks after the sale of Salome that she was white and had as much right to her freedom as anyone, and was only to be retained in slavery by care and kind treatment. The broker who negotiated the sale from Miller to Belmonte in 1838 testified in court that he then thought, and still thought, that the girl was white. The case was elaborately argued on both sides, but was at length decided in favor of the girl by the Supreme Court, declaring that she was free and white, and therefore unlawfully held in bondage. The Reverend George Bourne of Virginia, in his Picture of Slavery published in 1834, relates the case of a white boy who, at the age of 7, was stolen from his home in Ohio, tanned and stained in such a way that he could not be distinguished from a person of color, and then sold as a slave in Virginia. At the age of 20, he made his escape by running away and happily succeeded in rejoining his parents. I have known worthless white people to sell their own free children into slavery, and as there are good-for-nothing white as well as colored persons everywhere, and no one perhaps will wonder at such inhuman transactions, particularly in the southern states of America, where I believe there is a greater want of humanity and high principle amongst the white than among any other civilized people in the world. I know that those who are not familiar with the working of the peculiar institution can scarcely imagine anyone so totally devoid of all natural affection as to sell his own offspring into returnless bondage. But Shakespeare, that great observer of human nature, says, "With caution, judge of probabilities. Things deemed unlikely, even impossible, experience often shows us to be true." My wife's new mistress was decidedly more humane than the majority of her class. My wife has always given her credit for not exposing her to many of the worst features of slavery. For instance, it is a common practice in the slave states for ladies, when angry with their maids, to send them to the Calaboose Sugar House or to some other place established for the purpose of punishing slaves and have them severely flogged. And I am sorry, it is a fact that the villain to whom these defenseless creatures are sent not only flog them as they are ordered, but frequently compel them to submit to the greatest indignity. Oh, if there is any one thing under the wide canopy of heaven horrible enough to stir a man's soul and to make his very blood boil, it is the thought of his dear wife, his unprotected sister, or his young and virtuous daughters struggling to save themselves from falling a prey to such demons. It always appears strange to me that anyone who was not born a slaveholder and steeped to the very core in the demoralizing atmosphere of the southern states, can in any way palliate slavery. It is still more surprising to see virtuous ladies looking with patience upon and remaining indifferent to the existence of a system that exposes nearly 2 millions of their own sex in the manner I have mentioned, and that too in a professedly free and Christian country. There is, however, great consolation in knowing that God is just and will not let the oppressor of the weak and the spoiler of the virtuous escape unpunished here and hereafter. I believe a similar retribution to that which destroyed Sodom is hanging over the slaveholders. My sincere prayer is that they may not provoke God by persisting in a reckless course of wickedness to pour out his consuming wrath upon them. I must now return to our history. My old master had the reputation of being a very humane and Christian man, but he thought nothing of selling my poor old father and dear aged mother at separate times to different persons to be dragged off, never to behold each other again, till summoned to appear before the great tribunal of heaven. But oh, what a happy meeting it will be on that day for those faithful souls. I say a happy meeting, because I never saw persons more devoted to the service of God than they. But how will the case stand with those reckless traffickers in human flesh and blood, who plunged the poisonous dagger of separation into those loving hearts which God had for so many years closely joined together, nay, sealed as it were with his own hands for the eternal courts of heaven? It is not for me to say what will become of those heartless tyrants. I must leave them in the hands of an all-wise and just God, who will, in his own good time and in his own way, avenge the wrongs of his oppressed people. My old master also sold a dear brother and sister in the same manner as he did my father and mother. The reason he assigned for disposing of my parents, as well as of several other aged slaves, was that they were getting old and would soon become valueless in the market, and therefore he intended to sell off all the old stock and buy in a young lot, a most disgraceful conclusion for a man to come to who made such great professions of religion. This shameful conduct gave me a thorough hatred, not for true Christianity, but for slaveholding piety. My old master, then, wishing to make the most of the rest of his slaves, apprenticed the brother and myself out to learn trades, he to a blacksmith and myself to a cabinet maker. If a slave has a good trade, he will let or sell for more than a person without one, and many slaveholders have their slaves taught trades on this account. But before our time expired, my old master wanted money, so he sold my brother and then mortgaged my sister, a dear girl of about 14 years of age, and myself, then about 16, to one of the banks to get money to speculate in cotton. This we knew nothing of at the moment, but time rolled on, the money became due, my master was unable to meet his payments, so the bank had us placed upon the auction stand and sold to the highest bidder. My poor sister was sold first. She was knocked down to a planter who resided at some distance in the country. Then I was called upon the stand. While the auctioneer was crying the bids, I saw the man that had purchased my sister getting her into a cart to take her to his home. I at once asked a slave friend who was standing near the platform to run and ask the gentleman if he would wait, please, to wait till I was sold in order that I might have an opportunity of bidding her goodbye. He sent me word back that he had some distance to go and could not wait. I then turned to the auctioneer, fell upon my knees, and humbly prayed him to let me just step down and bid my last sister farewell. But instead of granting me this request, he grasped me by the neck, and in a commanding tone of voice and with a violent oath exclaimed, "Get up, you can do the wench no good. Therefore, there is no use in your seeing her." On rising, I saw the cart in which she sat moving slowly off, and as she clasped her hands with a grasp that indicated despair and looked pitifully round towards me, I also saw the large silent tears trickling down her cheeks. She made a farewell bow and buried her face in her lap. This seemed more than I could bear. It appeared to swell my aching heart to its utmost. But before I could fairly recover, the poor girl was gone, gone, and I have never had the good fortune to see her from that day to this. Perhaps I should have never heard of her again, had it not been for the untiring efforts of my good old mother, who became free a few years ago by purchase and, after a great deal of difficulty, found my sister residing with a family in Mississippi. My mother at once wrote to me informing me of the fact and requesting me to do something to get her free. And I am happy to say that, partly by lecturing occasionally, and through the sale of an engraving of my wife in a disguise in which she escaped, together with the extreme kindness and generosity of Miss Burdett Couts, Mr. George Richardson of Plymouth, and a few other friends, I have nearly accomplished this. It would be to me a great and ever glorious achievement to restore my sister to our dear mother, from whom she was forcibly driven in early life. I was knocked down to the cashier of the bank to which we were mortgaged, and ordered to return to the cabinet shop where I previously worked. But the thought of the harsh auctioneer not allowing me to bid my dear sister farewell sent red-hot indignation darting like lightning through every vein. It quenched my tears and appeared to set my brain on fire, and made me crave for power to avenge our wrongs. But alas, we were only slaves and had no legal rights. Consequently, we were compelled to smother our wounded feelings and crouch beneath the iron heel of despotism. I must now give the account of our escape, but before doing so, it may be well to quote a few passages from the fundamental laws of slavery, in order to give some idea of the legal as well as the social tyranny from which we fled. According to the law of Louisiana, a slave is one who is in the power of a master to whom he belongs. The master may sell him, dispose of his person, his industry, and his labor. He can do nothing, possess nothing, nor acquire anything but what must belong to his master. Civil Code, Article 35. In South Carolina, it is expressed in the following language. slave shall be deemed, sold, taken, reputed, and judged in law to be chattels personal, in the hands of their owners and possessors, and their executors, administrators, and assigns to all intents, constructions, and purposes whatsoever. Brevard's Digest, 229. The Constitution of Georgia has the following. Any person who shall maliciously dismember or deprive a slave of life shall suffer such punishment as would be inflicted in case the like offense had been committed on a free white person, and on the like proof, except in case of insurrection of such slave, and unless such death should happen by accident in giving such slave moderate correction. Prince's Digest, 559. I have known slaves to be beaten to death, but as they died under moderate correction, it was quite lawful, and of course the murderers were not interfered with. If any slave who shall be out of the house or plantation where such slave shall live or shall be usually employed, or without some white person in company with such slave, shall refuse to submit to undergo the examination of any white person, let him be ever so drunk or crazy, it shall be lawful for such white person to pursue, apprehend, and moderately correct such slave. And if such slave shall assault and strike such white person, such slave may be lawfully killed. Brevard's Digest, 231. Provided always, says the law, that such striking be not done by the command and in the defense of the person or property of the owner, or the person having the government of such slave, in which case the slave shall be wholly excused. According to this law, if a slave, by the direction of his overseer, strike a white person who is beating said overseer's pig, the slave shall be wholly excused. But should the bondman of his own accord fight to defend his wife, or should his terrified daughter instinctively raise her hand and strike the wretch who attempts to violate her chastity, he or she, saith the model Republican law, suffer death. From having been myself a slave for nearly 23 years, I am quite prepared to say that the practical working of slavery is worse than the odious laws by which it is governed.